Well, I hope you're not disappointed in me. I hope Dr. Koppus isn't disappointed in me. I've taken such a large chunk of the Bible. It all goes together. I could have taken the covenant part apart, but I believe it ties it together. This ends this whole episode of his life of Laban. Now he goes to the future and gets to meet Esau. He's scared spitless about Esau. He doesn't have to be scared about Laban anymore. It's dealt with after 20 years. Laban hassles Jacob's family here in the opening verses, 22 to 35. Let's go back, although so many verses. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled, that he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days. There we see a tribal pursuit. He takes his brethren. That is the idea, more broader than just his immediate brothers biologically, but by family. This is a tribe. We must not forget they were tribal back then. And so he's taking a bunch of families, and he's the head of this family. And I don't believe they're coming without arms, we shall say. We can see how insistent he is upon getting those household idols, as a good pagan would be, right? Or a bad pagan, not to confuse the children, as a bad pagan would want to do. He is the head of several families. He's intense and determined. And 7 quick days, he pursues them nonstop as fast as he can to get after him. Although Jacob had a head start. He's going to get him. He has a smaller party, more likely, and catch up with him. Nevertheless, God stops him and stops him cold in his track. It's not the first time God has given a dream to unbelievers to get their attention in a culture that takes dreams seriously. Today, the hearts are so hard, and they would have a dream, and they was like, yeah, whatever, too much LSD last night, you know. I'm in the Mile High City, what do you expect? That kind of stuff. Back then, they took it more seriously. It's quite fascinating that way, isn't it? Our hearts, in many ways, are perhaps harder today in Western civilization. So he hears and sees. We don't know exactly. We obviously hear. We don't know if he saw a God, what manifestation he gave. Just a dream by night. And God says to him, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. That is, you're not in charge. He obviously does speak to him. He's not saying don't speak, because whatever you say is going to be good or bad relative to God's law. This is just an idiomatic saying. You'll see this elsewhere in the Bible. You have it with children as well. Those who don't know either good or bad are younger people in the covenant community, for instance. Here he's saying, I'm in charge. You better be careful. You can't come to him as though you're the one calling the shots. Although he tries, as you recall, in his diatribe against Jacob, well, I could harm you. It's in with my power. But, you know, I guess I'm going to have to pull back because your God's telling me no. So he still tries to kind of muscle his way in the way he's talking to Jacob. And God doesn't strike him dead. That shows you how merciful God is, even with the likes of Laban, the scoundrel. Laban is warned. And what's the first thing that struck me was this. Laban obeyed God, and it's not his God. Laban had the fear of God, not a godly fear, like Paul talks about, you know, you have sorrow, even a godly sorrow, and intimating that there are people who have sorrow. It's not godly sorrow, obviously. It's a fake sorrow, or it's a superficial sorrow, or a short duration sorrow. This is a fear of God. It's a short duration of fear. Once he makes a covenant, I think he thinks he's safe. Because he's making a covenant with the representative of that God, Jacob. That's how they thought back then. He had the fear of God of one degree or another. And I think perhaps if we struggle with that, maybe that should be a slap to myself or the rest of us. How seriously do we obey God? The pagan obeys God. Laban, therefore, has a muted wrath. It's there boiling in his conversation, his diatribe, right? So coming after Jacob verbally as close as he can without what he thinks is violating God's commandment. Don't touch my Holy One, right? These are my people. He's got a muted wrath there in verses 25 and 30. So he overtakes them there in verse 25 and catches up. And they're separated there on the mountain, and he meets them probably like a parley, meeting halfway. And Laban says to Jacob, what have you done? that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword. And he goes on and gives this litany of things. Oh, you know, I can't see my kids anymore. I can't hug them anymore. I lost my family. Oh, by the way, you stole my gods. His speech is, in that sense, erratic. He mixes some truth, of course. He did steal away, but a lot of exaggerations. And I'm going to go through some of that list here. He gives a false protest. You stole my daughters. And what's interesting is, you recall in the previous chapter, the daughter said, you sold us. We're like, you just sold us to you. You don't care about us. You sold everything you had anyways. Everything you got from Jacob, you've squandered, they said. So that's kind of laughable. So a false protest about stealing daughters, a false mourning or sorrow. I would have given you a going away party, right? You see that? I might have sent you away, verse 27, with joy and song, with timbrels and harp. Does anybody believe Laban would have done that? This miserly old man, who's a stranger to his own daughters, because he's more interested in making money and being out in the field and getting rich than being there with the children and the grandchildren. And he's a grandpa now. Of course, they didn't retire the way we do today. Nevertheless, I think it's false mourning. I would have given you a going away party. Uh-huh. A false love. I could have kissed my children. Remember what the wives said. The wives would know. He's a stranger to us. Our own father is a stranger. We're willing to go. It is true today. It's not a besmirchment upon the women, but they love their family. They've got a good family. They don't want to leave their family and go to the man who lives across the country. It's hard. Of course it's hard. Here it was easy. Like, sure. Who's this guy? Oh, our grandpa? Oh, I didn't realize that. That's a really bad family relationship going on there. So I could have kissed my children. Yeah, right. And then, of course, the arrogance. I could mess you up. It's in my power, he says. It's in my power. But, you know, I got to relent a little bit because you've got this big muscle guy, this God of yours. Remember, they don't think of him as God as we think of him as God. They're just big, powerful people of sorts. They have people dispositions. They fight and squabble amongst themselves. They're just very strong. Kind of like the Greek gods. If you know some of the Greek stories, and they go back and forth, and they're not omnipotent. They just talk like they're omnipotent. And so he doesn't take God that seriously. He's still arrogant there, saying, it's in my power to do you harm, verse 29. But the God of your father spoke to me last night and said, hey, keep your mouth shut, let him go. That's the gist of it, isn't it? Then finally we get to the real reason. Not because he misses his children, not because he wanted to give a going away party. You know, Jacob, you and I are bosom buddies, right? You took my idols. He took my household gods. Here's the real, all this other stuff is just fluff to soften you up. He's still trying to work the angles with Jacob, right, as a scoundrel. You stole my household gods. Probably for prosperity, given who he is. He thinks these gods will help keep him rich if he loses Jacob. And then Jacob, after 20 years, seems like he exploded. 20 years. It was short insofar as he's got a family, he's got his kids. It was long insofar as he ends up with an extra wife. And he's got this miserly father-in-law / employer. That's hard to do. I've worked my father. I honor my father. I love my father. I had a problem because I was a teenager working with my father. It's my fault. It's hard. He did it for a long time. He was a better man than I am. So Jacob gives his response in verse 31. Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. There we have more evidence that something else was going on, that he's bringing arms to bear, and that he has the forces with him. It's a scary declaration, however, where he says, find whoever stole and you can execute them. How many children here know this story? The kids are like, what, me? Am I listening? You guys know the story? Well, the other kids aren't quite sure. Jacob's wife stole Laban, this guy who's got a sword, stole something of his. And Jacob said, go ahead. Whoever you find, you get to execute them and take back what was stolen. So what do you think is going to happen next? Well, I think the children are... You're going to hear it. He's scared, and he gives a scary declaration. This is the first time you heard it. It's his favorite wife who could die next. He's completely ignorant of this. Laban's scrutiny here, verses 33 to 35. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, to Leah's tent, and the two maids' tents. That tells you how rich they are. Everyone had their own room. Tent slash room. He didn't find them. So Moses is done. The next part, he drags it out. You notice that? It's very short. No, nothing, nothing, nothing. Oh, here we go. Here we come to Rachel. Now Rachel had taken the household idols. She's next. Put them on the camel's saddle and sat on them. What is she up to? What is she up to, children? And Laban searched all about the tent but could not find them. Search, groped, handled, and felt. It's the same word in which Isaac does when he gropes Jacob for his fur, his skin. He's thorough. It's all about the tent, moving, poking, and prodding things to find that little statue. Just, I have in my head, whether right, wrong, or indifferent, something like Aladdin, you have the tents and you have the fancy pillows. They did. They would lay on the ground. He's just going through every little thing he can find to find these household idols. So apparently they're not very big. He's adamant. He will find it. And how would you like to have your father-in-law, 13 years into your marriage, vigorously search through your private home? You'd feel a little bit of invasion there, wouldn't you? I'm sure the wife would, too. I love you, Dad, but you know, this is my husband. This is my house. What do you think you're doing? And Rachel has some cleverness here. She takes the household idols, sits on them, and then says, sorry, I have the manner of women with me. And Laban's like, well, he keeps looking some more, and he comes up empty-handed. He finds nothing. Rachel is safe. Rachel stole. That's wrong. I'm not going to undermine that and ignore that, children. She sinned. God used this sinfulness to make Laban look like a donkey before Jacob. Put Jacob on the higher end of the bargaining deal, and they came out equals. See that? That's what happened. God used his providence again, as I preached before. Ordinary, boring providence. You do your duty like he did. He worked hard for 20 years, and yes, some interesting, miraculous things that seemed to occur with the sheep, but a lot of the parts of the sheep was normal crossbreeding. You can see that clearly in the text. So he worked hard. God uses ordinary means, and things work out, even though it doesn't look like it's going to work out for you more often than not. That's why you're here today, and many of us are prosperous in spite of our foolishness at times. So Jacob, now his full wrath is strong. He vindicates his name. He gives a rebuke, verse 36. And Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban and answered and said to him, what is my trespass? What is my sin? Why have you hotly pursued me? There's a language there again of hotly pursued, typically used for armed soldiers coming after you. You got a lot of nerve, Laban. A lot of nerve. Coming into my house, accusing me of stealing things from you, digging around, poking around, prodding, maybe just probably pushing around the servants and everything else. I can imagine him doing that. And you find nothing. Who do you think you are? Well, I think you would probably be a little angry too. And I hope the best biblical sense of the word anger, a proper zeal for truth and uprightness. You're not in the wrong. Jacob gave him, as they used to say, the what for. I don't know if they say that anymore. Maybe I'm getting old now. Gave him the what for. He got his comeuppance. You falsely accuse me. You have no evidence. For 20 years, I worked with you as a miserly man. He didn't use the word miserly. He says, you changed my wages 10 times. What he said to his wife's in private, he tells him to his face. You're a cheat. Without using the word cheat. A con man in so many ways. A deal breaker. Someone who's not trustworthy. Why do you think I ran? I don't think I could work with such a guy for 20 years. But it's quite interesting what you must do when you don't have much of a choice. It's not like you get a job somewhere else in the middle of the desert. We forget that. Laban isn't living in a city. He has his own little city, as it were. Jacob can go back to his home, and at the time he came, he had, it seemed like, no talent. He was a man of soft, creaturely comforts, remember? We have to remember, like Jacob, sometimes we have to persevere in some situations where we can't do much anyways, and God will strengthen us. As he strengthened Jacob, he survived, he even prospered through working with such a man. Jacob did his job, he says, and then some. He did his job, sweating bullets during the day and freezing at night. That's what happens in the desert. We forget that. The kids don't realize that. I remember when I was a young kid learning about that, I'm like, what? It's cold in the desert? What are you talking about? It's a desert. It's hot. No, the change difference in temperature is so radical. They're cold. They even have snows on little mountains. You read about in the Bible a little bit. But here, you're not going to be aware of this unless you know ancient Near East history and culture. The tradition did not hold the shepherd accountable for the loss of the sheep. If you can show the animal, typically, you're fine. Hey, I didn't steal and eat it. I got attacked by a wolf. You know, I got attacked by a bear. I got attacked by a lion. And they'll just take your word for it. You couldn't go to court with them. But here, what do we see? You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. This guy didn't even follow custom from his own pagan country. That's how much of a scoundrel he was, and how much of a taskmaster, we would even say tyrant, in America. What a terrible boss. I had a company somewhat like this. They wanted me to pay for my cell phone. We never had cell phones. They said, we want you to have cell phones. Why? So you could be on call 24/7 as an engineer. And, of course, that's what they want. I want a job. So I said, sure. And they said, you need to pay for it. And I said, no. I actually said it this way. Do we have to, I mean, who owns the account? We do. Okay, then you guys should be paying for it. We reimburse you at the end of the month. Me and another engineer didn't do it. Everyone else struggled for 6 months to get their money. I called up the Quest or whoever it was at the time and verified who's the name of the account, who gets billed. Oh, you get billed? Okay, well, I told the secretary, bill's coming up. They need to pay for it. They never did. They got penalized for it. I never got in trouble. He couldn't quite pull that off. That's how blessed we are in America. He couldn't quite pull it off. He's sitting there of his own money paying off for lost sheep when he shouldn't have. You worked me like a slave, treat me worse than servants, cheated me with my marriage, then my wages, and you have the gall to accuse me of stealing from you. Wow. This is really something, buddy. That's what he says. And God vindicates him, verse 42. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. I would have lost everything. But God was good to me. He did what? Children, he protected me. He protected his church. Jacob acknowledges this. He says, this is the God who is watching over me. He vindicates Jacob through the quietness of providence. And now it finally gets loud. There's no miracle short of God telling Laban, watch what you say. Be careful. Because I am watching this guy. I am protecting him. Given that Jacob and his family were the only church on earth, it makes sense that God would use extraordinary providence as he did at the time with the dream. Everything else was ordinary. Nothing else in here. The covenant isn't extraordinary. There wasn't a voice from heaven saying, make a covenant with Jacob, right? Jacob, make a covenant with Laban. None of that. Being the only church on earth, it makes sense that God would do such miracles at this time. And we have it there, and we don't have such a promise today for our particular church. It's not like we're the only perfect church. I know people like to say that about the OPC. I consider that slander if they say it seriously. I know people joke, that's fine. I have thick skin. I joke about myself too. God secures Jacob's safety, verses 43 to 55. And Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, and these are my children, these are my flocks, but what can I do?" Really? After what just happened? I give you a reprimand, you're caught empty-handed, as it were, on the flip side, not stealing, but not finding the evidence. This Laban guy just doesn't quit, does he? Wow. But as much as a scoundrel he is, get the little litany there. And that's just what we know here. I mean, you can imagine other things he did. Jacob still makes a covenant with him. It's an intimate agreement. Here, it's certainly intimate. They have a meal. That's what they typically did with covenants back then. To seal the deal, they sat down and had a meal. Because the covenant is a form of friendship, of whether, as it were, political friendship. Not like they're going to be best buddies, right? Political friendship, as we would say today. We have international covenants that do the same thing. We're not going to hang out with the Russians or whoever else we make covenants with. We just want to make sure we're not going to get in a war with one another, and that's good and proper. So here, Laban, who is less than truthful, trying to sound loving, as I point out, wants peace with a powerful foe and a powerful God, and with Jacob, who is blessing him, or God's blessing him through Jacob, as he sees Jacob as his special toy, tool. He obliges, and I think Jacob sees the wisdom in making a covenant with such a man close to him. A man who's also strong and powerful. He has his little army. He has his sheep. He was prosperous. He was blessed under God. And he'll just keep that extra and just add on to it. He's not a fool. God has given him wisdom as much as he's fool in other ways. So he has wisdom. Are we wiser, I think? I don't think so. To see ourselves above working with the unbeliever. Who's our boss? We make a covenant with our company. When we use the word covenant, we use the word contract with unbelievers. And you work with them, and you find out something's a little squirrely going on here. And we have such prosperity and freedom, you can drop the job and find another one. It may take you a month or so. Although this economy, I hear it's harder. I haven't been in the workforce for a while that way. You didn't have as much back then. So I'm not saying put up with abuses that way. But there may become a time when you might have to. You say, well, I guess I got to have a job, and this guy's, it's not so bad. The police are going to come after him, and I need a job. Here, he's going to have a covenant, as it were, between two city-states. That's how big and powerful they are. He has a lot of servants. They're like a small town, both of them. And he wants to have peace with them. He wants to have peace with his neighbor, and that makes sense. It's reasonable biblically to make compacts with unbelievers if it works to what? Our advantage. I had that in Sunday school class. What's our purpose in politics? Peace and prosperity, or peace and protection of the church. Both. Right now it's protection. We'd be happy with just protection. So, they make a covenant, and they cement the covenant. They put up stones as a memorial for future generation. One reason is this. They don't have a bureaucracy back then. You can't do a paperwork and put it at the Taj Mahal. You all know what the Taj Mahal is, right? Remember when they built that, what, 15, 20 years ago? That's the big place out in Golden. That's the county seat for Jefferson County. Big and fancy. They didn't need to make it that big. They didn't need to make it that fancy. That's why we call it the Taj Mahal. We're making fun of the rich bureaucrats, right? Using their money so wisely. They don't have that back then. This is their bureaucracy. They have each other's word. They have a witness, perhaps, another city-state or another tribe. And they put up these mounds of stone, and they tell other people about it. Get the word out as fast as they can. Don't pass this boundary marker. My boundary marker. You there, me here. We're happy. Good. Mind our own business. Because many of the pagans, unless they're very powerful and strong and think they can get away with it, they don't want war. And in this case, I think Jacob is wise enough to see that Laban would be happy just to maybe even deal with him, maybe get a little prosperity just by being close to him. I mean, the guy's a pagan. He thinks like superstitiously. Who knows? And they have the meal to seal the deal, as I showed. I mentioned to you as well. That's typical in the ancient Near East. And what's interesting here is that Laban offers this as a boundary of peace treaty, verse 53. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Laban offers it as a boundary marker and a peace treaty in the same time. I believe in the name of theism. I know they put capital G here. That's an interpretation by the NKJV, the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor. Nahor is the father of Terah, the father of Abraham. He didn't have the same God that I'm aware of. Abraham's the one that started. So I think it should be lowercase g. And Abraham's God, that would be our God, Yahweh. The word judge is plural. There's another indication that he's thinking of them as three different gods. Laban is. On the flip side, Jacob doesn't swear according to that swear. Jacob swears by the fear of Isaac, his father, by one God. Same covenant, two worldviews, two law systems, all that language we hear at times in reform circles. Two different significations, two different purposes to some extent. They overlap enough to have a covenant, but his is for his family's sake, not for necessarily, I don't think it's for Laban's sake at all. He just does it for the peace for his family. That's his purpose. It's a different purpose, same covenant. Different intent, same covenant. We have that. We have to not forget that. And yes, I think this applies directly to the Sunday school lesson I've done. God protects Jacob there. Through the thievery, he brings Laban to the end of himself. That is, he thought he was something. He thought he was going to get away with things. And now he ends up being equal with Jacob and no longer his superior. That's what I mean. So he's humbled that way. He even brings Laban through normal providence, ordinary providence, or special ordinary providence, as I had the other sermon, geared toward you, his people. Here, a covenant with him. Jacob comes out the better end of the deal. God protects Jacob from the wrath of Laban through the twists and turns of providence, and even of the sins, and through the sins of the parties involved, such as his wife. Do you consider God's protection of you? Not just Jacob, of you, of your family, of your life. He kept England from being dominated by the Roman Catholic Spain. They had the largest armada assembled with 130 ships back in 1588. One was on the way to England. They were on the way to England with thousands of troops ready to invade the mainland. They were the power of the day. They were the America, the nuclear power of the day. England was outnumbered, outclassed, and outgunned. And as the one history report is, the true knockout blow of this mighty armada came courtesy of, well, the pagans say Mother Nature, we say God. A storm wiped out most of the armada. It wasn't the English that won. God came along in ordinary providence. I mean, we see storms come and go. Nothing miraculous about that. Protected England from being a Roman Catholic subsidiary of Spain. As was reported of Philip II of Spain, I sent my fleet against men, not against the winds and the waves. Protected America from being Roman Catholic, like the Canadian Providence in the 1700s with the Quebec Act. That's one of the fears that we had in the American Revolution. It was that England would force religion upon us again, like they did upon the Northern Province and Canada. England owned Canada, don't forget. They owned the colonies and Canada. They said, Canada, you get to be run by a bunch of Roman Catholics. And the Protestants in America were like, ah! And God protected them. The social political battles we fight today would have started in the early 70s, I discovered recently, if God had not used an unknown housewife named Phyllis Schlafly back in the 60s. That's an amazing story. Can't believe I was ignorant of that for so long, because I was there in the 80s when she was a powerhouse, although I wasn't aware. I mean, I was a teenager. What did I know? She stopped the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have brought us where we are today socially back in the 70s. You realize that? She saw it. She said, you'd have women draft. You'd have women in the draft. And the senators, you know, the ones that don't read the bills, and the congresses of the states are like, oh, we didn't see that. Really? Okay, good. Get rid of it. And they did. It was three or four states shy of being in the Constitution itself. The Senate was in favor of it. Dominated by the Republicans. The Congress is a favorite, dominated by the Republicans. And Nixon was in favor of it. And it was part of the Republican platform. This unbiblical, dangerous idea that we're all equal the way they want equal, as though it were a mathematical equation, right? And now we're being bludgeoned to death with it as a culture. God used her. What of your family? Do we take our physical safety for granted? I hope you don't as much now when you see cops being bushwhacked as they were again this week in Pennsylvania. I think it was in Philly. And possibly again in Dallas. That sudden stop on the ice that did not result in an accident, do you think about that and remember that that's God protecting you? The broken car in the middle of Kansas but still having cell phone access, that's God. No miracle there. You can't say that cell phone accident. There's a tower. You can find the physical tower nearby. But it's God, nevertheless. In the mundane, ordinary parts of life, the job that you almost got, that you really wanted, turned out to be a loser of a job. God protected you from your decision. All the near misses and hits in your life, that's God. Write down a list, brothers and sisters. Give it to your kids. Pick a couple of memorable ones, especially if your kids are involved with it, like in a car. That's God. That's God, kids. Because I can't do anything with ice. I'm just free-flowing. Woohoo! You think it's cool when you're 8, but you grow up, it's not cool anymore. Take time, I say to you, to contemplate God's protection of you and yours in this church. Take time to teach your children these things. Take time to thank the good Lord. Let's pray. We thank you for protecting us and continue to protect us, God. And I know we wish the protection were always the way we want it and when we want it, but it's not. And that's a good thing because you're a God of infinite wisdom and knowledge and you know what we need. But we know one thing we will always get and never lose, and that's the salvation of our soul. And even if we lose our body, we will be given a better body. We will have no more pain and sorrow and heartache and hunger and hurt. We long for that day. Come quickly, Lord Jesus. Amen.